from Milieu Media Group, in association with Project Curie. This is The Relay, a podcast exploring what it means to build transformational, justice-driven communities and relationships today, with your hosts, Luke Brawner, and me, Sekonda Joseph.
Sekonda, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Did you have a happy Thanksgiving?
I did. I had a really good Thanksgiving. I ate so many sweets. And the food, nice. Like everything, was so on point. I know this show is not about what I brought. However, I made the roast and it was off the chain. Nice. So yeah, proud
well
of
done.
Myself.
Well done. Awesome. Okay, so we're starting a whole new conversation today.
Yeah.
Another conversation that requires, in my mind, a fair amount of nuance. I think it can be a complicated conversation.
Yeah, I think it can. And I think part of that reason is because there's so much work being done now.
Yeah.
And that I think from the time of a lot of the movements that was happening in the, I'll say the 60s, mm-hmm. with, you know, folks fighting for liberation as it relates to the LGBTQIA communities. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of work that's been done.
Yeah. So we're talking about queerness.
We're talking about queerness.
Okay. So my first question, I guess, is why on this show, which is seemingly all about race and racial equity, did we decide to work queerness into the conversation? Why did we dedicate what's going to be at least two episodes to talking about queerness?
Because queerness is not necessarily or only a sexual identity. Mm-hmm. It is also a politic.
Okay.
Right? And I think if you want to that expanded on, if you look in Wikipedia, they have a great sort of definition that talks about the history of queerness, which, you know, just talked about how the word was introduced, how one time it was... It wasn't always, I don't think, widely accepted. It had been used in a more derogatory meaning as well. Mm-hmm. And then some folks decided that they were going to take the word and make it their own, and they did. But one of the things I think that kind of stood out to me or that kind of helped sums up why I think we chose this word is... So, again, I'm reading this from Wikipedia. I'm not reading a whole definition for y'all. Y'all go check that out. But I think just this paragraph will help you understand why we chose this. In the 2000s and on, queer became increasingly used to describe a broad spectrum of non-normative, anti-heteronormative, and anti-hormonal normative sexual and gender identities and politics. Academic disciplines such as queer theory and queer studies share a general opposition to binaryism, normativity, and a perceived lack of intersectionality. Some of them only tangentially, I tore that word up, that's not what it says, but okay, we're gonna move on. Connected to the LGBT movement, queer arts, queer cultural groups and queer political groups are examples of modern expressions of queer identities. So queerness is, again, it is not only an identity, it is also a politic.
And it seems to me another reason to work it into this conversation is because of the shared trauma, the shared experience around the prejudice in both race and gender, sexual orientation, those sorts of things, that there's a shared experience there.
Yeah, there's an, and I'm funny about saying that. So I won't say that.
Okay.
I think I use queer because I wouldn't say that. And I want to be clear, like if this conversation was about white gay males, we wouldn't have this conversation.
Okay.
All right. I think queerness is a, and that's me as a black mm-hmm. woman saying that. But I think queerness, particularly in this conversation, talked about with people of color who also may identify as a queer politic because it just talks about what's considered what's the norm, mm-hmm. right? And what's accepted, right? And that there's an expansive way of moving and being and living that's not just in this particular box. And I think that's why queer was so important, because I think the more we get into what queerness is, I think the more that I think people of color can identify with the community. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk
if
then.
That makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Let's talk about who's at the table in this conversation. So neither of us was a part of this conversation.
No.
So who's at the table for this conversation?
It is Jude Fang, which
Jude.
You all knew.
Yes.
Jude is always in the combo.
Jude, we need to add him to the credits because he's on so much.
Jude is, so I'm going to say this about Jude because we said a lot of things about Jude because he's been here so often, right? But this is what I want to add to this. Jude does a lot of work as it relates to identities. Mm-hmm. And he, for me, has like so much knowledge. You know, when you're talking about people who are like doing the work and adding to this conversation and pushing the conversations as it relates to not even so much as it relates to sexual orientation, but as it relates to identities mm-hmm. and humanities, right? And Jude is like, he's straight up an expert. And then we also have Dr. Jessica Davenport, who just adds this, I don't know, the way she sort of, y'all know Jessica, but you'll hear it when you hear the show, like her language around and her thought process around just queer identity and being a woman. Anyway, it's dope. So, and then who you all don't know, our guest is Janae Ariel. And Janae is an artist, and I don't even just want to say an artist. I think I feel better saying that Janae is a creative
mm-hmm.
because so much of their work is done.
So broad.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it's art, and it's art with language or poetry, and it's acting mm-hmm. and it's dance. It's just, there's
music,
a lot.
Yeah, all kinds
music,
of stuff.
All sorts of stuff that Janae does. And within all of that, like there is, I think for Janae, there is queerness within her politic of working. Mm. So, yeah.
Perfect. Well, why don't we go ahead and jump in then to the first part of our roundtable on queerness.
Thought we'd just jump right in. We kind of did a little bit of pre-conversation where we'd say like, you know, we maybe talk a little bit more about some of our personal stuff so that people can kind of have a framework of what our entry points are before we kind of get into how it really influences kind of our thoughts and other things. So I don't know if either of you want to start kind of sharing a little bit.
Sure, I can start. My name is Janae Ariel. I'm a queer, black, non-binary woman, originally from Baltimore, Maryland.
Thanks.
Cool. I'm Jessica, and my preferred pronouns, I suppose, are she, her, and I identify as a queer black woman, and I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas. I've been in Houston for about 9 years, I think.
And then me, Jude, Asian American, Chinese, Taiwanese American, first generation here growing up in the States, identify as a transmasc non-binary, use he or they pronouns. Functionally, he, I think, tends to be easier. And grew up in the DFW area, been in Houston for a little over 10 years now. Hmm. So, yeah. Cool. Thanks. Yeah, so just jumping in, I guess, we're talking about like queerness as both an identity and as a politic, right? I thought this was an interesting framework and premise for talking about queerness, because I think sometimes when people think about queer folks, they think about this like, you know, maybe this like out and proud kind of identity and that's it. But then there's a whole theory and there's a whole framework behind how queerness as a concept even evolved. And then for people who really spend a lot of time thinking about it, even how it influences, not just as like an identity that influences thing, but really as the theory of what it is, how it influences the things that we engage, right? I'm curious, I'm going to start with you, Janae, just because you're an artist and I'm always really, I just feel like there's so much there. I don't know if you'd be open to sharing a little bit about how kind of you see queerness, you know, in the fluidity of your identity and how it plays in with the art that you do, or how you choose to engage with it, or how you choose to engage the wider world through those things.
Yeah. Man, I feel like I've always been queer. I just didn't know the language for it. And queerdo is like my actual essence. I love being weird. I've always embraced that. Mm. And yeah, I've always created. I've always had ideas in my mind that I wanted to bring forward. I'm an avid dreamer. Pretty much remember my dreams every morning when I wake up from the night. And they really impact kind of how I see the waking world. Which I feel like is so related to queerness, just developing a world that is out of the status quo of everything we've been handed. I think for a while, I felt that I should be like within the confines of like a particular system. And when things didn't make sense for me, when all my friends were like in middle school, mm-hmm. fiending over boys and super excited, I was like, this is so weird because I just don't feel this way at all. And yeah, just like how that evolved over my life, I think I've kind of used art as an escape or a way to feel the most at home with myself, with the things that I was experiencing, whether I write. So I sing and I rap, I write, and I do like, I've been close, I like love fashion, and that's always been like, I'm really exploring like self-fashioning right now as mm-hmm. well, just how you have the ability to present how you want to present. I think, queer people just embrace all of those things. Like, I've seen the most amazing outfits, and you see how people really view themselves, and they're just extravagant, especially if I'm ever, you know, at Pride, and you see kind of, wow, this is really how people feel on the inside. Mm. And it's so different from, you know, no shade to Sears, but like Sears button-ups. It's like, you know, like, yeah, you have some tulle around your neck, and you just have on a full dress, and this looks great. And yeah, I think the two are just like so closely related. I think there is kind of, and I feel like I don't want to put pressure on it because I know sometimes they're queers and they're like, I'm queer and I'm not an artist. And I want that to be very established. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it is so closely related to art just because art always allows us to imagine and allows us to create. So even if someone isn't necessarily artistic, I think being able to create your own identity is art.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Thank you for that. I think for me, in terms of thinking about identity and queerness, I think the term queerness, I have a real love for it and an affinity for it because I think it's something that's like expansive enough for me to talk about myself, to talk about my kind of approach to the world, to talk about my sexuality. Even when I was young, I was listening to Janae talk. I think when I was little, So I should probably start here. So when I started to sort of come to and begin to articulate myself as queer, I remember having a conversation with my parents, and for them it was, well, how long did you know that? And for them, when I said I was queer, that means, okay, you are attracted to women, right? Mm-hmm. How long did you know that you were attracted to women, right? Did you know that you were attracted to women when you were little? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it was difficult to answer that question because the answer, at least for me, was no. But what I did know was that when I imagined kind of partnership for myself, it didn't necessarily look like the typical heteronormative configuration, right? Or even patriarchal configuration. Like there, for me, I didn't necessarily imagine a man would be there. I'm not even sure that I imagined that anyone would be there, right? In some cases, I felt like it'd be nice to have some sort of partner sometimes, and then maybe they live somewhere else, not necessarily with me, and we may get together sometimes and meet up and have a good time, and then we, you know, venture off and go and do some other stuff, and then we meet up the next month. And right, I mean, it was really, even as I grew up in a household where it was a heteronormative household. But I think in terms of how I imagined my life, it just didn't look like that. And so as I grew older and as these terms started to come into play, queerness was the one that I feel like I had the most affinity for because it allowed me that kind of expansiveness. It allowed me to have questions. It allowed me to not have any responses to those questions, right? Mm. Or to ask a different type of question around relationality and how I imagined it playing out in my life, right? Even questions around intimacy. Mm. I think a lot of my intimate relationships, my formative intimate relationships, were ones that were not arranged around romance. It was arranged around friendship. Mm. And so I wanted my romantic relationships to look very much like my friendships. And queerness allows me that kind of expansiveness to think about my relationships in that way.
Mm. Yeah, I also really resonate with queerness. And for me, I think queerness has always been more around identity, right? Like usually I think, I don't want to say what people think of, but I guess my assumption is that, you know, a lot of people probably when they think about queerness, they think about just, you know, a broader version of LGB stuff, which is like typically based on attraction, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was always gender identity based and, you know, from a very, very young age, knowing like, something's not quite right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to say it wasn't quite right, but it just felt different. It felt different than what was being imposed on me, right? And I think, you know, I think it's interesting because with the type of just information that people have these days and the type of resources and supports, you know, you're having kids come out at a younger age and mm-hmm. having more language to articulate who they were. But, you know, I would say for my generation or our generations, like maybe not as much,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think if I were able to, and I think honestly I probably could have articulated, but I don't know that the people around me would have understood. And I think I knew that very intuitively,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think if I were able to have articulated at a younger age and for that to have been confirmed, I might have like grown up in a more binary experience, different than what was imposed on me. But I think because that wasn't the case and I've been socialized in a certain way that's very different than I think how my relationships to my body and how it, you know, how it presents itself in the world now, I would say that, like, you know, at this point, I think even a really binary kind of trans identity doesn't make sense for me, mm-hmm. right? I think that...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about what you mean by a binary trans identity.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's such a range of how people identify, mm-hmm. and I always want to make sure that, you know, like, when I talk about my experiences, I'm not trying to invalidate other people's, right?
Yeah.
So that there are people who identify as transgender who, like, feel very firmly that they're either, like, you know, masculine identity or feminine identity, or specifically even male identity and female identity,
mm.
right? And it's a very binary transition from one to another. And that's how they understand themselves. And they might understand themselves within, you know, a gay relationship or a hetero relationship,
mm-hmm.
even through that, right? For me, I think because I was socialized, I think, through kind of like a, like the imposition was kind of these like female constructs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't reject those things. I feel like, I think there's so much power and nuance through femininity that I've been nurtured through, that I really understand, that I really value and admire. And I'm not rejecting that as a part of myself, right? But also recognizing that, at least in some relationship to myself, that that's not conclusive of all of that I am, right?
Yeah.
And so I think in moving kind of into kind of how I like identify and how I move through the world these days, like I think it definitely leans more masculine, but at the same time, it's not in rejection of, I think, the parts that I still consider really feminine in myself. And so I think queerness gives room for that kind of like broader world, right? I think when people try to impose either just a really binary gender identity or to ask me like, what is your, you know, what is your attraction or orientation? If that has to be defined based off of who I am and that's like non-binary, there's not a good label otherwise for that,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think queerness for me kind of really lends into that landscape. And Janae, I think even, you know, like you were saying, that as an artist, I've always considered myself kind of like, you know, kind of being artistic minded, even though I didn't have a medium to necessarily express that in that's usually considered artistic. I think because of, I think the curiosity and the questions and the openness of like what everything is, you know, and I think, yeah, fed, I think, through some of those experiences of mine.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious for both of you, as I even think about it for me, who are some of the artists, the writers, the activists, the friends maybe, who kind of helped you in your own articulation and thinking about queerness, both as an identity and also an approach, a politic, an artistic identity?
I'd say, so I grew up in Baltimore, did a whole bunch of all over the place. Ended up back in Baltimore when I was about 25,
mm-hmm.
24. And I found myself like in a new community of people that I had never previously known.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my first friends that I met, their name is Kylie Maxwell, I absolutely adore. And I'd always like had these feelings of like, wow, like I feel very, you know, not whatever has been put on me. In this case, I think it was more so with like sexuality. So I was like, yeah, I don't really feel like this. And they were the first person I was like, yo, like, I think that I'm like gay. Like, oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. which was like a lot for me to say, but they were so affirming and was like, yeah, and that's okay. Like, that's great. If you feel that way, you know, like, feel free to explore that. Don't be like afraid of it. And that was really comforting. I remember learning a lot about like Josephine Baker. I was like really, I still am very into Josephine Baker. Mm-hmm. And just like all of the amazing things that she did besides being like a entertainer and a spy that, you know, she was queer and had a whole lot of kids.
I didn't know that.
She had a whole lot of kids. Oh my goodness. She adopted so many kids. I can't remember and I don't want to get the number wrong, but it was over 10. Mm. And she had a house for them and she was an orphan as well. Mm. So she, and I was like, yeah, that's so, I just was super fascinated by her life, especially the time in which she was alive, that she really did what she wanted to do. And is a legend for it. And that to me was very profound. And I think, those are the two people who come immediately to my mind.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me to think of specific people because I think, not that mine is the only one, but the journey has been so long, I think, in being able to articulate that I think there's been a lot of micro instances. Mm-hmm. But I would say, I think at least a formative moment, I remember being in college and I remember one of my assignments, it was an extra credit assignment that my brilliant South Asian feminist, like sociology professor, who I like adore, and I think is brilliant, cannot speak highly enough of her. But, you know, she asked us to do an extra credit assignment where we would actually go to attend some artist performances and then to do like a write-up on it, right? And then around the same time, she was also giving us readings that was essentially helping us think through and frame up the concept of intersectionality, which is kind of my first introduction to that term, right? And so that kind of fused together because the particular performances that I went to were two South Asian queer folks. One was trans, who I think these days identifies as non-binary. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting and watching and feeling like there's almost a fear of being seen. You know, when you see something that like resonates so deeply that you haven't been able to, like, that you haven't been allowed to kind of like live more openly, mm-hmm. right? And so I remember being almost a little bit scared, but also a little bit excited. And then also this person's not, you know, the people aren't exactly like me. So I was also like, this doesn't feel entirely right, you know? So, I mean, because it's still different. But I remember walking away with that experience. And then I think to be able to, I think through it in the concept of intersectionality and to think through some of my experiences in terms of what has been allowed and what has been lost in the systems and spaces that I've been in was helpful in thinking through parts of myself that have not been able to be expressed or explored. And that through a framework of marginalization. But also, I don't know, sometimes personal stuff can be hard to navigate. So I think by having kind of an academic framework to move through it felt a little safer as well. Yeah. So that was like, I remember that being very distinct.
Yeah. I think I had a similar experience in terms of the kind of academic experience with queerness and that kind of introduction to it through academic study, right? Like through college and seminary and being introduced to, you know, writers like Audre Lorde, reading Alice Walker and her work was really formative at that time. And two, though, I think what was probably the most informative for me, and again, similar to you, Jude, it's sort of these little moments. It's not like it goes back to this like one defining, right? You know, moment in time. That's just not how we live our lives. But I do remember certain moments, and one of those was when I was in seminary. I was around this group of women who, some of whom identified as lesbians, some of whom just didn't identify at all, but they had this incredible community together, and it was Black women who were in Atlanta, and they were connected to one another. They were protective of each other. They would, and I, strangely, right, this group of Black women would meet like every week to watch like the L Word, right? Like the whitest, I mean, you know what I mean? Representation of lesbian life on the planet, right? Mm. But they would get together and, but at the time, right, it really, the L Word was doing some work, right? It was one of those only shows that even sort of put, you know, folks who were lesbians on the map in terms of representation. So they would get together like every Sunday in someone's living room. And of course, you know, folks were talking back to the screen, critiquing it, whatever. But there was also a real appreciation for you know, the show. So I was like sitting around with these, you know, with these folks like every week. And but they never once asked me, like, are you gay? Are you lesbian? Are you queer? Like, please identify yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. There was just this openness of, I mean, she's here. We like her. She's a part of our community. But never once was there this sort of hard demand in a way for me to identify. And I think that is where I really began to sort of feel an openness and an affinity, not just for queerness sort of as an identity, but as a community. Right. Mm-hmm. There was a way in which outside of that community, folks were demanding that I identify. Tell us who you are, right, before you enter into this space. So we know and we can kind of understand where you're coming from. That was not the experience with them. And I think that was really foremost in my mind of this feels like home to me, right?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I can think back even, you know, like to younger years, at least high school, you know, where kind of what you're saying, there's, I almost felt like, you know, when I was in high school, it was the 90s, so older than I look. But, you know, but I, you know, I think people were starting to begin to be more like, not by and large, but I think being gay was at least understood enough, and some people were being supportive. But even the supportive people, it felt like a witch hunt sometimes to like out you. And then it was so militant. It was like, we must know. And it just, it didn't feel like a safety or an invitation to be known. It was like a, it just felt something objectifying. Right. Even by people who are supposed to be supportive. That's and, you know, and I've been with supportive folks, you know, because my queerness is related to my gender identity. I've also been in spaces where people, I think their support was much more positive, but because the projection that it was a sexuality thing, it also felt very disorienting. You know, there's a lot of dissonance around it. But I think to what you're describing, Jessica, I think about even like the queering of friendships, kind of what you're saying, and the queering of relationships and kind of that intimacy, that openness that it allows. And, you know, as I was listening to you talk about it, I was like, you know, I actually feel like in many ways that feels very intuitive and common in communities of color a lot more sometimes than I feel in white spaces, right? Or even like, you know, spaces with people of color that I think ascribes to more kind of like white culture, right? And so sometimes I think it blurs for me, because what does it mean between queering something versus really just claiming something outside of like a white supremacist framework, right? So I'm curious what y'all's thoughts are on that. Is that too intense? Are we getting too intense?
No, we need to go there.
Janae, you gonna latch us into that?
You can go ahead. Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, it and this is I'm gonna kind of wade into this, because this is where I can, this is where like the academic part of me like jumps out, right?
See the light in your eyes. Give it
so
to excited. Us.
So like there is this she's a scholar and she's like incredible. Zakiya Jackson is her name. And she has this argument, and I'm sure she has, you know, gotten it from someone else, right? I mean, that's kind of how academics work, is that, you know, very little of the thought is original. It comes from community. But she, yeah, I mean, she has this argument, and she's talking specifically about, not necessarily people of color, but talking specifically around Black communities, right? And her argument is that, you know, Black folks are always and already queer. And her idea around that is that, and it kind of goes back to this other scholar by the name of Horton Spillers, who basically says that in terms of like a normative, white, patriarchal family structure, which is really the way we understand normative gender identity, right? A father, a mother, and all those roles that we attribute to that, right? To what it means to be man, woman, he, she. that Black folks, through the context of slavery, have never been able to really fully live into that, that was snatched from Black folks, right? That patriarchal structure. And so because of that, there has rarely ever been a time where Black folks have fully lived into this idea of these patriarchal structures where you have a man who is working outside of the home and a woman who is whose life is fully and totally committed to a domestic life inside the home, right? Mm-hmm. Black women have always worked outside the home, taking care of children that were not our own, right? Many of us doing all kinds of work, factory work, industrial work outside of the home, that has been our story. And so her point is that, there's always been a kind of queerness to us that has been a part of our lives and a part of our history, and that that is a richness there to that, right? That that is not something that needs to be reformed or brought into subjection to patriarchy, that we need to become more like, you know, the patriarchal structure. She said, no, we need to sort of understand and celebrate the richness that this allows, right? And that that Black family structures have always been extended family structures. So yeah, I had my mother and my father, but many Black folks had their grandmother and their aunt and two uncles living in their main household, right? That that is a kind of queerness that has to be celebrated and lived into for the kind of possibilities that it allows for us in terms of imagining beyond those kind of heteronormative structures. So I say all that to say, yes, I do think, and I agree with her, that Black folks, and I would extend this even to folks in terms of POC communities, I just haven't done the work on that, fundamentally queerness, absolutely, and that there's a richness to it. Yeah.
Wow. I never thought about it like that, but that's so very true. I was just at the Project Rojas this weekend. They're opening H-Tex People Project. I was in the house and it said, like, it's about mothering and motherhood. And it's from a lesbian couple. And did you see this?
Well, no, I heard about it. Yeah, I really love Morgan and Bria, who, who curated that.
Nice.
I feel out of it. I was supposed to go this weekend, but I got too busy.
Definitely
go. I didn't get a chance to see it either, too, but I hope to see it.
I absolutely love the house. But anyway, at one point on the wall, they have a lot of writings on the wall. And it was one of the perspectives of the mothers was saying that she was raised by her mother and her aunt, and like that was that seemed like a couple. It seemed like they were already in a relationship, and I was like, "Whoa!" Like, so here to hear you say this, I'm like, "Yes, this is now like day three of me hearing this and really pondering on this and thinking, And then even if you think back to like how we were, like I would love to know. I don't know like where my ancestry's from, but I'm like, if you're like in a tribal situation, if you were in a village situation, like things are not. Things are not the way that they are here. And even like, and even sometimes it feels like very American. I lived in a, I taught in a village in Spain and there's 5,000 people there, but everybody looked out for everyone. Anyone would invite me into their home for lunch, dinner, you name it. People looked at people's, after people's kids, you could tell people's kids what to do. And it wasn't, and even for me, like, even though they are European, coming from where I'm from, I'm like, wow, that's so, so different. And I wonder, sometimes I feel like all these systems, and I also used to teach. I heard you say you teach. I also used to teach. It's like, teach within the context of this country, and it was so different. You know, you couldn't really, you didn't want to overstep. Or sometimes I would say something to a parent like, "Hey, you know, like I would love it if your student could be more engaged." The phones, the cell phones, and it was like, "Oh well, you know, I mean, like, why are you even talking to my kid?" And I'm like, "Wait, what?" And how? Yeah, with all this. I'm like literally whiteness, but sometimes it's like bleach. Like it's just like this has to be very sterile. These are sterile environments. Like we're not going to show love across all of these different places, across all these different spectrums. Like I can't even hug a student if they're crying. You know what I mean? And like when I think about, and then you're raising kids in that, you're already creating all these divisions and separations and then like pushing, you know, the patriarchy on them as well. It's just like, wow, no wonder they come out of school and they're just like messed up, you know? Like just don't even know how to relate to one another because everything has to be like so sterile.
Yeah. No, I feel, I don't even know if we're getting off topic, but I'm like flashing back to my teacher memories now where, you know, because I think the aspect of nurture and kind of that like raising as a village concept feels, I think also as a person of color, it feels more intuitive, right? Like I very much grew up in like, you know, a family that was really connected with other Chinese American families. And, you know, it was a small community, but it was a tight community because there was just nowhere else and no one else, right? And so there was a lot of like interdependence and kind of like community reliance, right? I would say, you know, the class status that my family grew up in, maybe there wasn't as much of that for financial interdependence, but certainly for community and support, and including like, I don't know, like my mom's, like one of a really good family friend of ours, you know, when the mom started working again, she would literally just call my mom up and be like, I'm dropping my kids at your house. Like, it wasn't an ask. It was like, I'm telling you, I'm dropping my kids at your house, you know? And then I'd just be like, cool, my best friends are here to play with me today. Like, I had no idea what was going on. But anyways, that's a little bit derailing. But, you know, I go back to when I was thinking about teaching, and I know it's also different for me as an Asian person. They probably don't view me as threatening, but I would come across the same kind of dynamics with parents. And I felt like I always had to bring in this invitational language about how, like, we are working for the betterment of our kids together, and to really try to bring in that collective language. And what was really interesting was that, you know, of course, everyone would resist it, you know, at the start of the year. And by the end of the year, I was like their favorite teacher, right? And I think it's like shifting that. But I'm even thinking about the aspect of the sterilization and touch, right? I feel like to talk about not using touch feels like a very cis-normative masculine concept of it's like this is teaching and this is purely about information, right? It removes the aspect of nurturing and I think femininity, and even though like teaching is such a feminine profession these days, right? But like I think in queerness there's a certain claiming of I think these things through the different spaces, right? And I feel like, you know, in a very like not creepy way, like I feel like kids need touch. I think humans need touch, right? That's a form of connection. And if like some of, I think, the most powerful nonverbal communication and forms of care I could give to the kids was a pat on the head or a pat on the shoulder when I was like walking through the room acknowledging them and their work, right? It wasn't like this huge verbal, like, you know, hands behind my back. I really like, you know, there's moments like that too, but I felt like the nonverbal was oftentimes more powerful. I don't know like why people try to like separate, you know, like what is masculine, what is feminine, and to try to pull that out of things. Like I feel like that moves towards the human disconnection when we just try to categorize, I guess.
Okay, so what jumps out to you in this conversation?
I think what jumps off to me, I thought about like this conversation being like a seesaw, right? Just roll with me, y'all. And like on one side, you have heteronormativity, right? Okay. Or even whiteness on the same side of this seesaw. And the other side, you have queerness, right? And it's going back and forth. So it's like this compare and contrast between these things. And I think that's very easy for people of color to understand, right?
Is that because, and I'm really asking to understand what you mean, is that because of the power dynamic at play that whiteness and heteronormativity have in common? Or how do you mean that?
Okay, there's two things. So I think it is the power dynamic. That's one layer of it. Absolutely. I think another thing is that I think for, and when I say people of color this time, because it gets on my nerves when people say people of color and they get to my black folks.
You're saying it on purpose.
Okay, I am saying it on purpose. I think for, even when I think about black folks or when I think about folks from other places and you hear them talking about sort of what are the histories of these peoples prior to colonialism and enslavement, right? And they didn't necessarily, heteronormativity did not look the way that it looked, right? So whiteness, even within our heteronormativity, it's very different, right? It shifted, right? So I think that's something else that they're speaking of, right? The way that generally people who are not white, right? Or what's, so say normal, right, that everyone doesn't live that. That's not necessarily normal for us, even being so far removed from these places and spaces that existed prior to colonialism and prior to enslavement.
So whiteness then being white normative thinking? Like would you say that on that side of the seesaw in that illustration, you could have just about any part of normative culture? Is that right? Or am I misunderstanding?
I think you brought up a question about like So is that how we see it, right? I think, but I, in no way do I think that's what they're saying. I think they're saying for the majority of folks who are people of color, right?
Okay.
That queerness is common. It is the norm, right? It is the normative, but it's not the power structure. So I think within that, because they begin to just describe, and I mean, you listen to the conversation, and this is my opinion on what I heard,
sure,
based on what I identify with, right? So I think that's also, there's bias in there, right? But I do believe that, and in this part of the conversation, because, you know, we ain't got to part two,
right?
But I'll say that. But I do believe in this part of the conversation, they are exploring cultural identities and sort of what's normative in non-white cultures, right? And how those things are. And I definitely don't want to exclude the talk about heteronormative, right? Because I think, you know, that is brought in, I think. But what's also brought in is that we don't live normative cultures anyway. Like, this is not, like, what's considered the norm.
Right.
Right? For the most of us, for folks of color, like, none of those ways are normal, are what's considered normal. And I think I'm going back and forth because I really want to make sure that I don't, whether I'm talking about, like, folks of color, whether I'm talking about queerness, put that on a place of, like, this is the alternative, like the other thing, right?
Because
I think that's how society works. And I think sometimes, but that's not, that's how society is spoken of by the people who generally, you know, I guess in control of society, for lack of a better word. But I don't think that is like real life.
Right,
for most of us. I don't think that's real life for queer folks, right? And I don't think that's real life for people of color. And I think that's what this conversation is kind of exploring, and there are so many layers, and I think they're peeling those layers for us.
Well, they did so beautifully, and I'm excited to get to the second part of the conversation next week, which will be our last episode for a little while. So we're going to take a break for the holidays and to sort of reimagine what we want the next season of this show to be like. I think a little bit of housekeeping in the meantime is we would love to hear from folks who are listening to the show. We'd love to hear feedback. We'd love to hear questions. We'd love to hear what direction you would want to imagine this show as we try to co-create the future together, co-conspire in this work. And so we would invite folks to email us at therelaypodcast@gmail.com and just let us know your story. Let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear it. All right, Sikandha, we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
See ya. The Relay is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Bronner. It's co-produced by Dr. Jessica Davenport, and our artwork is by Heather Hale. Check out more of her work at halehouse.co. Learn more about Project Curate at projectcurate.org and The Relay at therelaypodcast.com. For bonus content from this and other Milieu Media Group podcasts, check out the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode.